her birthday, so we let her celebrate by relaxing for the evening. And still, several people have asked me several times whether or not it was possible to know Christ as a person and as a Savior in the same way that I had mentioned knowing Him. And knowing Christ and what was involved in this. And so I thought it might be a very interesting thing to ask Margie if she would tell us to very informally about her own knowledge of Christ, where this came from and what it meant to her. And then afterwards, I thought perhaps we would share a little bit of our Christian testimony as a family. But Margie, without any more introduction than that, and you must know that I could say as many things about you as you can say about me, but we better not start that. would you share with us about how you became a Christian and what this means to you?
I haven't really prepared anything, but I'm sure you know I can remember whatever long time ago. But it is most refreshing to know that in Christ and the life that I have had in Him has been a refreshing thing, even though it happened a long time ago to me. It's just still and much more so wonderful every day. I grew up in a Christian home. My father was a minister, and of course, being a dutiful daughter, I went to church with the family very regularly. But it wasn't until I was in my teens, I was 15 actually, when I was at a conference that I heard young people, one after another, give their testimony about what Christ meant to them. And to me, this was something different in that these young people seemed to be Christians. The young people that I went with were fine enough as far as going to church was concerned, but I realized that my life in Christ wasn't what it should be, that going to church and obeying my parents and doing what I thought was right was not all that was in the Christian life. That Christ Himself loved me and gave Himself for me and wanted me to become His. And He was asking me to take Him into my heart. And this was a very easy thing to do. It was what I had wanted, but I never before realized that I must ask Christ to come into my heart. I had just been growing along as my parents had been teaching me and my faithful teachers in Bible school, but I came to this realization that I myself must give my life over to Christ. And you may laugh at this, but I thought, well, if Christ really is real, he'll help me in all of my problems. And I had a lot of them as a teenager. And one of the first ones, problems that I asked Him to help me with was my desire to quit biting my fingernails. Now, as I said, you may laugh at that, but I really couldn't stop breaking that habit. And I said, well, if this is true, and I must confess that once in a while I had some doubts, well, is this something I have done? Because I haven't really known not to, if this was something that just came along and I accepted it. If this is real, and I thought it was, but I said to the Lord, this is a problem that I can't handle myself. And I forgot about it, and later on I realized I had no desire to bite my fingernails. And I let that go for a while, and I didn't bite my fingernails for a long time. I still don't. But little by little I began to commit areas to the Lord, some things that I couldn't handle, my attitudes or my desires that I knew that were not right with Him. And I would commit these to Him. And He has been very loving and patient and very close to me in time of trouble as well as in time of rejoicing, because I know that my Redeemer liveth. And I love Him very much. An illustration of this was brought to me on my birthday, just before I came here the last time. Into my bedroom walked my three little children, and they each had a present. And I looked at their eyes as they sang happy birthday, and they were just blooming, and they sang happy birthday to me. And I looked at them, and I thought, well, they love me. And they did, and they had a present for me.
And they wanted to do something for me because I was their mother. I was somebody special to them. And that touched me very much. And to me, the Lord is someone who loves me very much. I am someone very special to him. And he has given me a gift above all gifts. And that gift is eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. And day by day, this is so refreshing to know that there is someone who cares about every problem I have, every attitude, every thought, every word, and has already planned for me what I should do. My problem is to take my ignorance to him and ask him, what should I do? What would you have me to do?
Time that I met Maggie was very interesting. We won't get into that too much in detail. I was back at college. It was just after I had come out of the Navy, and it was good to have Maggie around because she was the school pianist. And I think this was probably the reason why I was first interested in her, because I was planning some meetings there at school, and I knew that if I dated Marty, I'd never have any problem insofar as the piano was concerned. But by and by, I noticed too that it was good to have her around for other reasons. I always liked to be where she was, and I knew there was something different about her. I still wasn't a Christian, and still, things seemed to go right insofar as Marty's being there was concerned. And the other girls seemed to have a certain confidence in the program if they saw Margie was there, but they didn't have if they knew I alone was there. And this was true not only for the girls, but for the boys. And it was good in whatever program we were working in to know she was there. Shortly after this, I became a Christian, as I shared with you here one other evening. And I still wasn't seriously interested in Margie for some time. And then I can never remember any particular problem insofar as wondering whether or not God had a wife for me. I just knew that Margie was the one that I was going to marry. I had a terrible time convincing her of this fact. I told her of it several times, and she didn't believe me. And it didn't bother me particularly that she didn't believe me, because I knew it was going to work out in the end. We separated for a whole summer, going our separate ways. And this was at the end of the college course, just after graduation. I was traveling with a quartet across country, across the United States for the summer, and Margie was doing other church work. We came back and started, I started into a seminary for some more training. Margie was teaching. And a friend of ours was married. She lived in Niagara Falls. She had been Margie's sweet mate back at school, and he had been a very good friend of mine. We'd grown up together back in New Concord, Ohio, years ago. I was the best man. Margie was one of the bridesmaids. And Willard called me one day and said, well, you're going to have to find Margie and bring her up to Niagara Falls for the wedding. I said, I don't even know where she is. And he said, well, find her, because she doesn't have any other transportation. So we asked around and finally found out where she was, and the trip to Niagara Falls was a lot. It was almost too much. But by Thanksgiving time that year, we were married. Well, I guess it was over Thanksgiving vacation. The thing that has been uppermost in our thinking since we've been married is also tied in with our Christian testimony of both of us. I can remember my first point of concern when it suddenly dawned on me that perhaps Christ wanted me to go into some kind of full-time Christian ministry. And I was really wondering what impression this would have on Margie. I don't quite know why I wanted this, but I wanted to ask her this question. So I asked her, and she said, well, it doesn't matter to me. If Christ shows me that a certain man is to be my husband, it doesn't matter to me what he does. I'll be right with him in it. It was very reassuring to me, although at this time she was quite sure that I was not the one. And I was equally sure that she was, and of course you see how it's turned out, so I can tell the story this evening. But we'd like to share with you this evening, too, one of the psalms. It's been a theme psalm for our home. We have a sort of an unusual home. It's always been open to people. From the very beginning, we moved in down at Bloomington a few years ago, and we've had people living with us almost constantly since then, not the year round, but very often we have someone there. Randy was counting up the other day, and I think we had served, how many years was it you had to figure out for the income tax people? It was a lot of them, and 100 or so people who had been with us throughout the year for overnight, and some of them longer than that. But we like it that way because we believe that Christ has given to us a home and a family, and we want Him to use these things. We'd like to sing for you as a duet this evening the psalm that we've adopted as a theme psalm for our home, the 127th psalm. I can't sing. That's the only problem connected with this. Margie's a musician in the family. She's already written one book of music and arranged and edited the thing, and she helps to keep me in line. But you'll also have to refrain from smiling in connection with the accidentals which I throw in from time to time. I thought some of you, well, why don't you, those of you who have Old Testaments or you want to look at the 127th Psalm, you'll see something of the words that we'll be using here. Margie, why don't you come over here, and then we can sing together. I'll have that stand up on this. That's the good one. We'll explain this as we go along, and then you'll see why we've used it as a family psalm. This is a do-it-yourself generation and age in which people not only build everything else, they also build their houses. They build their homes. The word, the Hebrew word for house here refers not only to the building, but also to the family. And the words begin in this version, which is the same that you have, except it's made up to be able to sing with some music. Except the Lord shall build the house or the home, the builders lose their pains. Except the Lord, the city keep, the watchmen watch in vain. Each city made up of so many homes.
Except the Lord shall build the house, the builders lose their pains. Except the Lord, the city keep, the watchmen watch in vain. 'Tis vain for you to rise betimes, or wake from rest to keep the bread of toil and sorrow. He gives his loved ones here.
Those words are interesting. They're very practical. 'Tis vain for you to rise betimes, or late from rest to keep. Of course, the hour for going to bed is set within the home. And God says it's vain to try to burn the candle at both ends, as we put it. To eat the bread of toil. Bread of toil, that's sleep. That's the bread, or the thing that gives us the strength to keep on going the next day. 'Tis vain for you to eat the bread of toil, for so he gives his loved ones sleep. Sleep's the thing that blesses us. It's not a thing that we have to endure, but it's a thing that makes us able to go ahead with the strength for the next day. And then the next stanza is a very interesting one.
Lo, children are God's heritage, and the offspring His reward. The sons of youth as arrows are, the strong men's hands prepare.
That's the picture of the archer. Children are God's heritage and offspring His reward. The sons of youth as arrows are, for strong men's hands prepare. It's a picture of the archer with his bow drawn at full length. The shaft of the arrow is clear back. And when the shaft of the arrow is full back, of course the tension is greatest. And if his fingers tremble just a little bit back here, then the arrow can miss the mark out of the target by many, many feet. And it's always interesting to notice that there are two Greek words for sin in the New Testament. One of them means missing the mark, and the other one means falling short. And in either case, the point is that we don't hit the target of life. And it's while our children, you see, are in our own hands in the home that there must be a good firm hand on the shaft before they leave the bow. Because after they leave the bow, and that happens so early anymore over here in Ireland, they still have their children until they're 18, 19, and 20, 21 years of age. But over here it's, what, 16, 17, they go off to college, and we have such a little bit of time. But that's what he's getting at here. Offspring are his reward. The sons of youth, as arrows are, for strong men's hands prepared. And then he carries that same figure of speech straight on through into the next stanza. Who hath his quiver filled with these? O happy shall he be, when foes they greet within the gate, they shall from shame be free. I'm not sure what gate this is here. I think it's probably the gateway of heaven. But the man who has his quiver filled with children, a very interesting way of putting that, happy shall he be. When foes they greet within the gate, they shall from shame be free. I think that every parent, as he stands within the gateway of heaven and sees his children following him in there, that this would be a source of greatest joy, one of the greatest that can be imagined. Now, again, I apologize for the way in which I've sung here, but the psalm means a great deal to us. The children can do better at it than I can, as far as the things themselves. One of the things that we like to do as a family is to work at the singing. At least two of them are following their mother insofar as their voices are concerned, and it's been very interesting to us to hear one and two and then three-part harmony beginning to develop around the breakfast table in the morning. We try to do some singing every morning before we start out. And you see the slogan every once in a while, the family that prays together stays together. I'm convinced that the family that sings together learns to develop a certain kind of harmony. And sometimes the attitude isn't always one of desiring to sing at the breakfast table, but once we've managed to lift our voices just a little bit, to this particular end, the idea of praising God, there's a lot involved in it. I go ahead and say that I do a lot better at the breakfast table than I was doing in here a little bit ago. But I feel very, very ill at ease at that particular point. Let's go ahead now and go into John, the fifth chapter. Incidentally, it was the warmness of your fellowship and the good time that we had here and have had here the last several evenings that prompted us to go ahead and even try to share this with you this evening. And I hope that we've been able to give you some insight into a thing that's very, very precious to us within the context of our home. And this is a thing that Margie commented on the other evening. I think it's a thing that you should be aware of, that there is a warmth of Christian fellowship within your group here. It is a very, very precious thing. I think it comes as a result of the fact that men and women have been learning about God. They have a real heart desire to know God. There are three things that I look for in a faithful man. Number one is a desire to know God. I don't think that anyone else can cause another person to want to know God. It's a very precious and a wonderful thing when you find someone that really has a heart desire to know God. The second thing I look for is a concern for the souls of other people around them, and a willingness to put yourself into another person's feelings. The philosopher tries to think through things from the other man's mind, from the other man's standpoint. A willingness to be concerned for the soul welfare, the spiritual welfare of another person. The third thing I look for is a willingness to pay the price. I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about the time that it takes to study God and to know Him. These are three things and in a very wonderful and interesting way, it seems to me that these three things are in evidence in the lives of those who've been gathering here recently. Let's read together from John, the 5th chapter. Suppose we begin, Dave, could we begin with you over here and read two verses? And I think we'll read the entire chapter down through verse 47. Verse 1, we'll read the two verses apiece and just read all the way around through the entire chapter.
After this there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is a Jerusalem by the sheep market, a pool, which is Bethesda, having five porches.
There is a great multitude of impotent of swine, all withered, ready for the water, ready for the moving of the water. For an angel of God in a certain season into the pool, and troubled the water. Whosoever then, first after the troubling of the water, stepped in, was made whole of whatsoever disease he had.
And a certain man was there, which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie, he knew that he had been now a long time in that case. He saith unto him, Wilt thou be made whole?
The important man answered him, Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me in the pool. But while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Jesus saith unto him, Arise, take up thy bed, and walk.
And immediately the man was made whole, and took up his bed, and walked. And on the same day was the Sabbath. The Jew therefore said unto him that was cured, It is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed.
He answered them, He that made me whole, the same said unto me, Take up thy bed, and walk. Then asked they to him, What man is that which said unto thee, Take up thy bed, and walk?
And he that was healed knew not who it was, for Jesus had conveyed himself away, a multitude being in the place. Afterward Jesus finding him in the temple, and said unto him, Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worse thing befall thee.
The man departed, and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus, and sought to slay him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day.
But Jesus answered them, My Father is working still, and I am working. This is why the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also called God his Father, making himself equal with God.
Then answered Jesus and said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise. For the Father loveth the Son, and sheweth him all things that himself doeth, and he will shew him great works, greater works than these, that ye may marvel.
For as the Father raiseth up the dead, and quickeneth them, even so the Son quickeneth whom he will. For the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son.
For all men should honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He that honoreth not the Son, honoreth not the Father that hath sent him. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that heareth my word, and believeth on him that sent me, hath everlasting life, and shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life.
And verily, verily, I say unto you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself.
And if he has authority to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man, nor will not ask this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice.
And shall come forth. They that have done good unto the resurrection of life, and they will have done evil unto the resurrection of damnation. I can of my own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which has sent me.
If I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. There is another that beareth witness of me, and I know that the witness which he witnesses of me is true.
The Son of John sent me to bear witness unto the truth. But I receive not testimony from man, but these things I say, that ye might be saved.
He was a burning and a shining light, and they were willing for a season to rejoice in his light. But I have greater witness than that of John, for the works which the Father has given me to finish. The same works that I do, bear witness of him, that the Father has sent me.
And the Father himself, which has sent me, hath borne witness of him. Ye have neither heard his voice at any time, nor seen his shape. And ye have not his word abiding in you. For whom he hath sent, whom ye believe not.
Search the scriptures, for in them ye think ye have eternal life, and they are they which testify of me. And ye will not come to me, that ye might have life.
I receive no honor from men, but I know you, that ye have not the love of God in you.
I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another comes in his name, in his own name, him you will receive. How can you believe who receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God?
Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuseth you, even Moses, in whom ye trust. For had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if ye believe not his writings, how shall ye believe my words? Now, we've talked other evenings about the connection between miracles and the discourse that follows those miracles. It's as though Christ were giving an object lesson, and then he was going ahead to explain it. First there was the sign, and then he explained the significance, or the significance of that particular sign. The miracle, and then the explanation, or the sermon that explained the miracle. And as you read through the scriptures, this is an important keynote, an important thing to notice. Sometimes Christ will make the statement of the principle, or the sermon, first, and then the miracle that illustrates it. But usually, very often anyway, it's first the miracle and then the explanation. Someone said, when you preach to the children, make it so plain that even the older people can understand. And there's something of this, it seems to me, in the way that Christ uses the miracle and then goes on into the sermon part. And this chapter here this evening is typical of it. The scene and the setting, does anyone remember offhand what the miracle was? We just finished reading. The miracle of and the man who, what was wrong with him?
Everybody said before
him. Right.
38 years, second, but not first.
All right. And too late, some sort of paralysis or withering. And to get the setting, this was probably 2 years after Christ had been in the temple first. He's back in Jerusalem now, probably the first time he had been back in Jerusalem. He walked in there the first time, you remember, and cleaned out their temple. The money changers had been there, and they'd been taking advantage. They'd been robbing people at the very time and place where they should have been blessing people. And Jesus had cleaned it out. He'd been gone for 2 years. Now he comes back. He comes to this pool of Bethesda, and there were maybe hundreds of people around this pool. And he walks out into the midst of them and heals this man. I don't know what would be the greater miracle. I suppose we'd have to appeal to a medical man at this point. What would be the greater miracle? To heal a sick man, or to heal a lame man who is, in this case, having something, he has something withered, something had been inactive for so long that, what happens when it withers? Something just goes out of it and disappears, I guess.
Yeah, there are a lot of changes in many of them.
All right. Would it be more of a miracle, then, to heal a man with a withered arm or a man who had the chicken pox? It seemed to me that there would have to be something replaced with the withering, whereas with the
person who had something sick, it would be a case of correcting a condition or a situation that existed rather than replacing something that had gone out of existence. And I mention this because it seems to me consistently, and here again, you'd be interested in checking through on the miracles, it seems to me consistently that John does not look for the easy ones. John looks for the ones that were more difficult. There were many other miracles, we're told over here, than Jesus did, which John did not include in his record. But he picked out the ones that for him had some particular significance. This man had been 38 years withered, and Jesus knew it. And yet Jesus turned to him and he said, "Do you want to get well?" I think maybe we can use a little bit of imagination here as we see this blind man who may also have been waiting there. And he gets up and stretches and he starts to move around. He bumps into someone else and he says, "Oh, what are you here for? Are you blind?" And the other fellow says, No, I'm not blind. I'm sick. Why are you here?" "Well, I'm blind." And they get into a discussion as to which is worse, and the blind man wanders off saying, "Well, it sure isn't so bad to be blind, at least I'm not sick." And the sick man wanders off saying, "Well, it sure isn't so bad to be sick, at least I'm not blind." And the Lord picks out one of them and he says, "Now you're not as bad as the other, so I'll heal you." No, I don't get this. I don't get this. I don't get the idea from John's record that Jesus picks out one that is not as bad as the others on whom to practice his healing. The answer is, when Jesus said to him, "Do you want to get well?" The answer is, "Yes, but there isn't anyone to help me get into the water." I don't know what the situation was here with respect to the water. Those of you who have the American version will notice that the fourth verse is not in there. And I think this is an important thing. It's not in there for a very good reason. The best manuscripts that we have, and it's almost a majority of them. If you get down into some of the other manuscripts, there are a number of them that have it. But there are a number of the manuscripts that do not have the first part of that fourth verse there. Maybe it's the whole verse, I've forgotten. But you see the problem that this leaves us in. Jesus, or God, did not ordinarily operate on the basis of the survival of the fittest, the first come, first served. If you can make it in first, well, then you're healed. He didn't ordinarily operate on that basis. The fourth verse provides some real problem for me, and I keep looking at the fact that some of the manuscripts do not include that fourth verse. I have to comment on it as we pass. Because it raises a question in my mind, does Jesus only take those who are most fit? I don't think that he does. I don't get the impression here that he was looking for the easiest one, the one that was most able to take care of himself, but rather that Jesus was looking for the one who could not get there and who had been there for 38 years with not a sickness, but with a witheredness. John seldom uses the word straightway, But he does right here in verse 9. Immediately, the man took up his bed and walked. There was no lapse of time whatsoever. This is an unusual statement for John, the instantaneousness of the healing. In verse 9, we have the miracle itself, the healing. Then, from verse 9 on through, Jesus is involved in explaining the significance of the miracle itself. This is what we were getting at the beginning, where first the miracle and then the significance of it. And it's the circumstances under which he was operating and the challenge that was thrown at him that helps to explain the significance of the physical miracle, as well as his own words. Verse 24, well, let's ask this question. Who was Jesus? What is it that Jesus proves himself able to do here in chapter 5? He's what? In what particular capacity or light does he appear here in chapter 5?
Healer.
The healer. Can we go ahead and say without too much stretch of imagination here, the giver of life? Insofar as that man with the withered limbs were concerned, he had a new dimension to life. Christ had made it possible for him to have a kind of life that he hadn't had up to that point. The one who gives physical ability, physical life in a particular sense, the giver of life. Can anyone find, of the verses that we have read, any place in here where Jesus claims the right to give life, the authority to give life? 21, all right, verse 21. For as the Father raiseth up the dead and quickeneth them, even so the Son quickeneth whom he will. And this is one of the best. 20, verse 26 is perhaps another one. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself, and hath given him authority, and so forth. Now, I think this is significant, that Jesus claims the authority to do that. Suppose you had walked out into the midst of a group of 100 sick people who'd been waiting there for months and months and months to be healed. The desire was there, regardless of what the circumstances was, the desire was to be healed. And you had walked over to one of them and said to him, now I'm going to heal you, and had proceeded to do that. What do you think the others would have said to you? And suppose you had said, but there can only be one.
Why him
instead of me? Who gave you the right to pick on him and to fix him and not fix me? Where'd you get your authority? Your right. You have the power, it's obvious. But what about the right to use that power? Where'd it come from? And so this would have been very directly connected to the whole subject of authority there. He gave life to whomsoever he will. Now, this is not the only point that's involved here, and we're just trying to pick these things up, and then we'll tie them together in a little bit. What was the other problem they brought up in verse 10? Right. And was it the healing on the Sabbath?
The work on the Sabbath.
All right, and the work was particularly he just picked his bed up and carried it off. Now, we don't think too much of this. We roll up our bedrolls, or we pick up a bed and walk off with us, but not those men, no sir. They had a rule to the effect that you could wear a shoe, you could not wear a shoe that had a certain size nail head on it, because that was carrying a burden. Nail head on it, because that was carrying a burden. You could go up to 2 miles for certain emergencies, but under no conditions, not one step beyond a certain 2 mile mark. And they had those 2 mile marks outside Jerusalem. Now, this was the meticulousness with which they had interpreted the commandments concerning the Sabbath and the keeping of the Sabbath. What was the answer of this man? Incidentally, these circumstances in which Jesus was accused, he was teaching or working or doing something, and then the scribes and Pharisees came along and accused him of certain things, accused the men whom he had healed. And it's a very interesting study to go through and study the answers that these men had given. Over here in the chapter 9, we come to another one that Jesus had given his sight to. And I want to see some of those men in heaven, because their answers to the ones who were accusing Christ are very, very keen answers. They gave some good ones. What is this man's answer to the scribes and Pharisees in the presence of their accusation? It's a keen one.
He said, he that made me whole told me to pick it up and carry it.
All right. Now, what's the significance?
Well, he had the authority to make me well. He also had the authority to tell me to break the wheel.
If he could make me well, then he has the right to tell me what to do on this particular day. He has the right. He has the power to do that. He has the right to tell me what to do. But he didn't even know who it was. They asked him in verse 13. He didn't know, however, because Jesus had conveyed himself away. But in verse 14, Jesus found it. Jesus always finds the man they kick out. He finds him, and he makes himself known to him. The man, however, knew that Jesus had authority, And so Jesus said to him, Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more. Don't continue in your sinning, lest a worse thing come unto thee. Now, I don't get the impression that Jesus is threatening him with more physical suffering. A worse thing has a spiritual connotation to it. It seems to me, from what Jesus is saying here, and also from what follows, that he's focusing attention not on this physical healing and the threat of another physical illness, but by worse thing, that there could be some spiritual suffering and very serious spiritual suffering connected with any other sinning. Don't just be satisfied, it seems to me Christ is saying down through here, with the physical healing. You come and let me care for your eternal healing, your spiritual healing. Let's not be focused just on this physical thing that's happened here. Let's see it only as a significant thing. The man went and told, do you notice what he did there? The man departed in verse 15 and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole, in spite of the fact that Jesus had told him not to tell. And therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus, and they sought to slay him. I don't know why it was that the man went and told anyway. Perhaps it was just out of sheer joy. I think that's probably it. But the point is that the character and the motives of the Jews are beginning to show up in their persecution of Christ. It had been promised that no matter what Christ did, he would be persecuted. You'd think if a man walked in and healed somebody who'd been sick for 38 years, that the whole community would rejoice. But they couldn't see that. The one thing they could see was that this poor man had picked up his bed and walked, and that this Jesus of Nazareth had told him to do it. And that was the thing that stuck in their craw. They couldn't get around that. The fact that the other man was healed didn't matter. Yes, yes.
Question. Why did Jesus tell him not to tell?
I think this...
Continue. I'll try to keep quiet on here.
Yes. I think it was because Jesus was having a problem with multitudes. And do you remember where the multitude pressed him so much that he had to push off in a boat in the lake? And there were times when he tried to get alone with the disciples to instruct them. And his purpose, one of his primary objectives, you see, on the one hand he's working with the multitudes, and on the other hand he's training these disciples. And if the multitudes pressed in too much, And frequently he dropped them in order to meet the needs of the multitude. But he had to have some time with them. I think this was one thing. I think he did not want to precipitate their threats to his life unduly. Now, there were times when they were already all set to kill him, and in a miraculous way he escaped. They were set to throw him down off the brow of a high precipice one time, and he walked out in the midst of them. And over again they sought to take him, but the multitude wouldn't allow them. Sometimes the multitude was the thing that protected him. At other times the multitude was a thing that kept him from spending more time with the disciples. I think that two things. One, it was not the time for his crucifixion yet. And the multitude that praised him one moment could also turn to be a mob that would persecute him the next. I think the other thing was the disciples themselves needed time with him. Now, these are two practical reasons.
He also feel that possibly he performed his miracles strictly to use as examples and analogies for his teachings with his disciples.
Perhaps he could have said,
you are all healed.
Yes, I think that there's this element, and a very important one. Now, I say this, keeping in mind always, that the bulk of his miracles signified his love for mankind. All his miracles, taken as a lump together, proved his love. And so there were times when he healed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, apparently. Then, on the other hand, there were those who said, in chapter 9 we get into this, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And Jesus said, neither this man nor his parents sinned, but rather that the glory of God should be made manifest. And it's obvious in that case, even more obvious than here, that the man was blind, as Christ said, in order that God's glory should be made manifest in his healing. I would accept this, keeping in mind, of course, that Jesus never just used people as little pawns in order to prove his points, but that always there was the love of heart. He never turned people away, insofar as we can see. This is the one occasion in which, out of the midst of many, he healed one. And this is the significant and peculiar thing about this miracle, as far as I can see. And it was so keenly illustrated in the one man who was desirous of healing for that long. This is a thing that Jesus frequently did in drawing a person out. He said to the disciples, when he knew that he was going to feed the 5,000, he said, how many of them are there? How much of a miracle would it take? And so they did some rapid mental arithmetic and came to a conclusion as to how much of a miracle it would be in terms of mathematical, in terms of figures. In this man's case, Jesus was saying to him, do you really want to be healed? He was drawing him out so that the man himself appreciated even more the extent of the miracle by saying, yes, 38 years I've waited here. 38 years of desiring. This is how much I want. Well, I'm not sure that the man was sick because he had sinned.
No, I don't mean it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And the man knew for 38 years how serious a thing it was that he was sick. And now Jesus said, something worse than this could happen to you. Worse even than the 38 years that you've already told us about. So let you not get the idea that this is to give you license to go and sin. Lest the worst thing than this happen, worse than 38 years of waiting. Yes, I think this is true. Have I read your question rightly? Well, suppose Jesus had not asked him that question, we wouldn't have known how much of a desire this man had. The impotent man answered him, sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool. While I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Now, this indicates the desire. He's right on the edge, but he still can't have this. He's right there where he can see it, but still he couldn't have it. The desire was there. Now, this was the unusual thing. Others expressed the desire. This has to do with the thing that we talked about one other evening. Which comes first, the miracle or the faith? And how do we know which comes first? Is it that a man believes in Christ and then Christ heals him? Or is it that Christ heals him and then he believes in Christ? Does Christ believe him and then does the man believe Christ and then be healed? Or does Christ first do the healing and then the man believes? Well, we traced through on a number of the miracles, and we found that over and over again, the man believed, and then Christ healed him to confirm the belief that was already there. This one is not clear because it says Christ asked him if he wanted to be healed, and then Christ told him to take up his bed and walk, and he did. Following that, the man came to the point of believing in Christ. But it seems to me that Christ is drawing out the man so that he would appreciate what it was going to happen to him, and that we would know of the intensity of desire that there was there. I can't see much more than that. It's interesting, the questions that Christ asked of the men each time before he did it. He asked them before they made the loaves and bread into fishes, or the fishes and the bread into loaves for the multitude. He asked them how many it would take. He asked the other man whose eyes he plastered shut if he would like to be able to see. He asked the blind men who sat begging by the side of the way if they'd like to be able to see. He asked each one of them certain questions. Well, there was an exchange of conversation almost in every case before he did any actual healing. Yes. Well, the people who were writing, I'm convinced, thought that it was an angel here. I don't understand this verse. This is why I say I am relieved to find that the better manuscripts do not have it. In fact, the American version leaves it out altogether.
Is this the one
that's only signed in the I think that it lends credence to these things. I know that they have used this as defense of their actions in places like this.
Well, now, of course, this spa existed without any benefit of touch. That's the second video.
Yes. That any healing that God would do, Christ would be involved in to some extent. I do not understand the verse itself. It's inconsistent, it seems to me, with the way Christ has worked, with the way God works in other places, to say, well, now, if you can make it down there, you can be healed, but if you can't, you can't. I just don't understand that.
Well, I would take something like that as merely hopeful. And it predated even the Jewish something like that.
Well, if we leave it out, if it's true that this particular verse, and you see when we get the first eight manuscripts here, the first four or five of them, I think it is, don't have it. Now there are three. One of the ones is a pretty good one too, that has it in. These are the old manuscripts that we make original copies of it, and. under these conditions, if it is folklore or tradition, other parts of the Bible, I cannot see as being folklore or tradition. But if this particular verse is to be left out, then I could accept it as being folklore or tradition. Yeah.
Does it still
prove
that the first person was God in the water was through here?
An angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first after the troubling of the water stepped in was made whole, whatsoever disease he had. If that verse is in there.
You know, what I mean is I hardly think that man has made it 30 years, you don't see that some visible
It's true.
Is
that first person, there's only one person
per season? Yes. Yes. The first one in. Yeah, something must have been keeping him there and the others too. That's true. I don't understand the verse. This is. Yes, it is.
I mean, it's like.
It's.
Someone taking the ribbon off his marriage because it's a little hard to accept the little difficult thing to leave it out.
Yeah, well, no, I'm not suggesting that the reason for leaving it out is that we don't understand it. I'm suggesting that the reason it has been left out is that it just doesn't appear in the majority of the best manuscripts that we have. And therefore, a number of the copies, the best, the good copies in Scripture just don't have it. Yes, and King James has it. That's true. This is the only verse that I know of in the Scriptures that I have this problem with. And it's not because I can't explain it or understand it. that I'm leaving it out. It's a combination of the two things. I'd rather not focus on that at this point. The thing that I would like to go on to is the explanation of Christ's purposes, which I think come to light in view of the desires of the man. I think this may shed some light on your question too. Man told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. The character and the motives of the Jews began to show up in their persecution of him. Jeremiah had promised us years and years before this that this would happen to Christ. The fact is that the man and Christ are not breaking the law as God had intended the law concerning the Sabbath to be kept. What God had intended when he said, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God, and thou shalt not do any labor, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, the manservant, nor the maidservant, nor the stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days God made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in was, for God also rested the seventh day and hallowed it. When God gave that commandment, he intended that men were not to be doing labor in gainful employment for 7 days out of the week for their own personal profit and gainful employment at their own choice. But they were interested, they were concerned, because they had gone on to interpret this commandment, and then they found that Jesus and the man here who had been healed were breaking their interpretation of that day. The man and Christ were obviously not breaking God's law as God had intended it to mean. But they were breaking their idea of the way the seventh day should be kept. They were breaking their interpretation of that particular day. And in verse 17, Christ goes on to begin giving them the greatest answer. Jesus answered and said, my Father worketh hitherto, and I work. Let's go on into this a little bit. You see, this is getting down to the crux of the matter. Does God work on the Sabbath? Does he work on this day? And Jesus, of course, said, my Father worketh hitherto, and I work. But what do you mean? In Genesis, we're told very specifically that God worked 6 days, and then he rested the seventh day. But how does God rest on the Sabbath? How long did God rest? As far as I can see, he worked the 6 days, then rested until sin entered the world. And then God worked. What is the spirit of rest, for example? Why does God work on the Sabbath? I think the answer is sin. Who was breaking the Sabbath then? The man who was carrying his bed and thereby giving testimony to the fact that he had been healed, or the Pharisees who were walking and continuing in their own attitudes towards this one whom, of course, we know as being the Son of God? Keeping the Sabbath, according to the Pharisees, meant resting. But if I were to ask you what the most perfect way of keeping the Sabbath would be, insofar as the old, old, old-fashioned, traditional way of keeping the Sabbath, what would you say? Keeping the Sabbath in the most conservative and safe. All right. Now, is this resting, or is this idleness? let your mind go just a little bit further on that. When is a person most likely to become restless? When they are idle? I think this is true. Restlessness really comes out of idleness. But these Pharisees had come to the conclusion that idleness was the best way to keep the Sabbath. Don't carry. The minute you do one bit of physical work, such as lifting or carrying, you have broken the Sabbath. If a person's idle, then he's keeping the Sabbath. Christ said, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work." And what tremendous rest we have doing the will of God. This is true rest. The real heart of the matter gets down there in verse 18. "Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he not only had broken the Sabbath, but said also that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." Now this is getting right down to the heart of it. They finally caught the point of his answer. This is the real issue. He was making himself equal with God. In effect, he was saying, "I'll heal whomsoever I will heal. I'll pick one man out of the whole multitude, and I'll ask him if he wants to be healed, and I'll raise him up and heal him." Anyone else saying that, it would be purely arbitrary and unmoral. I don't say immoral. I say it would be unmoral. That is, there would be no moral basis. He'd be acting without a moral basis for choosing this one instead of this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. It would be more like caprice or arbitrariness. It would be partiality. What I want, my prejudice. The only one who would be able to do that and do it right and in a loving way, in absolute justice, would be the one who had created all those people, even God himself. And therefore, Christ, in defending himself against their accusations on this particular occasion, refers to the fact that he is God. That's the gist of the conversation down here. Jesus says, down here, Jesus answered him, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work. Therefore the Jews sought the more to kill him, because he had not only broken the Sabbath, but because he had made himself equal with God." I don't know. Let's see if we can do a bit of recap on this. You see, they complain. They said, "You've just referred to God as being your Father in a very unique sense. You've insisted that you are God." And the question is, then, did Jesus soft-pedally answer? Did he say, "Well, no, no, maybe not"? No. In verses 19 through 47, Jesus is delivering one of the most sublime lectures on this subject, the subject that emphasizes the point that he is equal to God, that he himself is God. He's the one who alone has the right to give life. And he can find the one who's to have that life and heal perfectly. He demonstrates this right and this claim. And he does it in irrefutable ways. Just as in the miracle, he did things that only God would have a right to do. I wouldn't have a right to go out and pick one man. You wouldn't have that right. No one else would. But God would, to heal him on that particular occasion, in that particular circumstance and place. All these people were desiring it. This man was desiring it for 38 years. Had tremendous desire. He was so close. Every time I get close to the water, someone else gets in there ahead of me. Only God would have the right then to come along and heal this man, leaving the others who were perhaps equally desirous. Healing whomsoever he will. That's the significance of Christ's statements. He comes over that how many times on over here in the remainder of the chapter. "The Son doeth nothing of himself," he goes on to say down here. "What the Son sees the Father doing, that he does." And here again, he's driving in at his own deity. In 5:19, he emphasizes this. "Then answered Jesus and said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, what he seeth the Father do. For what things soever he doeth, these also doeth the Son likewise." Now, let me ask you this. Is this the description then of one person imitating another person? Of a son who's imitating a father? Of an earthly son imitating an earthly father, not doing something for himself, never doing something for himself, but what he sees the Father do, that he does. The Son can't be independent of the Father. He's saying, "What I see, I do. What the Son sees the Father do, he does." Never on his own, never independently, but only subject to what he sees the Father doing. Verse 20 is the same. "For the Father loveth the Son, and showeth him all things that himself doeth, and he will show him greater works than these, that ye may mark." It's imitation. Is verse 21 sheer imitation as we go on into that verse? Where Christ said, as the Father raiseth up the dead and quickeneth them, even so the Son quickeneth whom he will. Is that just imitation? I see the Father give life, quicken a person, so therefore I imitate him and I give life. Is that just imitation? I don't think so. I think there's something more here than sheer imitation. This is out of the realm of imitation. Let's go on for just a minute in verse 22, and we'll come back to that point, the point of imitation. It seems to me in verse 22 that the imitating is reversed. Now it's the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son. You see, the Jews had been complaining that Jesus had made himself equal with the Father. And Jesus began in verse 19 by insisting that the Son cannot act independently of the Father. What he sees the Father do, that he must do. He cannot be independent of the Father because he is the Son, and whatever he sees the Father doing, that he imitates. Now he goes on in verse 22 to say, neither can the Father do anything except he imitated from the Son. In verse 22, the Father judgeth no man, but hath committed all judgment unto the Son. He uses judgment to illustrate the point. In other words, God the Father is limited to working in vital union with God the Son, and judgment, the judging of men, is one illustration of that particular principle. As it is true that the Son can do nothing apart from the Father, so it is true that the Father can do nothing apart from the Son. And of course, this is true when we come down to think of it. How many gods are there? There's only one. How could the Father then do anything without the Son? And the answer is he couldn't. The two cannot work independently of each other unless there be two separate gods. If the Father and the Son can work independently, then there have to be two separate gods. But in John 14:10, Jesus went on to insist on this a little bit later on. He spelled it out in words. Here he's doing it in action, but there he's spelling it out in words. He said, I am the Father and the Father in me. He does not speak for himself, but it's the Father in me that doeth the work. Now we have another picture of that same principle, and through the book of John, Jesus comes out with this in a dozen different ways. Here he's doing it in terms of a miracle. But over in John 15, he does it in terms of the vine-branch relationship, where the vine is in the branch, and the branch, the vine life flows into the branch. And as the vine life flows down into the branch, it produces fruit. It's not that the branch breaks off and goes over here on its own separately, apart from the vine, and produces fruit. It's only as the branch is related to the vine, so that the vine life is pouring down into the branch, that it can produce fruit. And this is another type of illustration, another means by which Christ is trying to get across the relationship between himself and the Father. You see, this is not the same as imitating the Father. Jesus was not just imitating God. This has been a thing that's plagued the world, Christendom, for years and years and years. Dr. F. B. Meyer tells about on a train one day, he looked across the aisle and he saw this boy reading a copy of Thomas Aquinas, De Imitatione Christi, The Imitation of Christ. And the boy was deeply involved in it. And finally, he interrupted the boy and said, what do you think of the book? It's a good one, isn't it? And the boy interrupted him then and began telling him about what a wonderful book it was. And finally, when he stopped, Dr. Meyer went ahead to tell him the rest of the story, but I'd like to tell you about something but. And then Dr. Meyer went ahead to share with him about how, as a boy, his father had been an artist. He said, as a boy, his father had desired that he would become an artist, and he had tried to paint. And there were times when his father would come along and practically put his hands over his hands and try to get him to paint in the colors and shade in the picture itself. And he was saying, if only, he still couldn't do it. He just didn't have the hands or the eye for it. He said, if only my father could have gotten down inside me and reached out through my fingers and looked out through my eyes and given me the balance of color and proportion, then it would have been possible. Meyer also went ahead to tell him how, as a young preacher, he had learned to admire an old preacher, and he had admired him so much that he had thought that in order to have this man's ministry, he would have to speak with this man's mannerisms and gestures and so forth. And so as a young man, he began to try to ape the older man's figures of speech and mannerisms and so forth, and how it had actually become funny at some places. But he said, on the other hand, suppose the older man could have gotten down inside him and spoken out through him, thought through his mind, loved through his heart, worked through it. And Meyer said, in effect, this is what Jesus Christ and God were. It was not that Christ was imitating God, it was that God was in Christ. God isn't interested in imitation. He's interested in the real thing. The indwellingness of Christ, of God. Now let's do a bit of recap again. In the fifth chapter of John, the Jews were saying, Jesus, you make yourself equal with God? And Jesus said, exactly right. Not by imitation, but by indwelling. He is in me. The Father worketh hitherto, and I work. He works in me and through me. My Father worketh hitherto, and I work. I work as the outward expression of an indwelling Father. With that in mind, looking at chapter 5 and verse 24, where Jesus said, verily, verily, I saith unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on him that sent me hath everlasting life. He hears my word, but he believes on him that sent me. God the Father and Christ the Son, he that heareth my word can go on to believe on the Father. You can't hear the word of Jesus without hearing the word of the indwelling Father. And you can't believe the word of Christ without believing in the Father, without believing that the Father is saying these words to the Son and in him. He that heareth my word and believeth in the Father hath eternal life and so forth. Now we go back to verse 20 for a minute, and back up there, the Father loveth the Son, showeth him all things that himself doeth, and he will show him greater works than these, which ye may mark. The lesser works, that was the man at the pool. That was important then, but it was not as important as some of the things that would come later. The Father, working through the Son, you see, had healed the man at the pool. Jesus is saying, it was not that I was imitating the Father, it was not that I was doing this independently. It was that the Father worked through me in doing that there. Greater works than these, however, shall ye see me do. There will come a day when the Father will raise the dead when the Son speaks. That's what he's talking about down there in verses 27 and 28. And hath given him authority to execute judgment also because he is the Son of Man. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming into which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice and shall come forth. In verse 30, Christ again asserts his equality with the Father. He says, I can of mine own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge. My judgment is just, because I seek not mine own will, but the will of the Father which I sent. In verse 31, if this is just a delusion, an idea of my own, then it's no good. But actually, he says, there are four witnesses which bear me out on this. One of them is John the Baptizer, whom you've heard and whom you've been. Another one of the works that I've done, and you can look at them and know that I'm not just doing these independently of the Father. A third is the Father himself, and a fourth of the Scriptures. These are the four witnesses that he refers to down through there. In verse 46, he goes on to speak about those who have rejected Christ. He says to the Jews there, if ye had believed Moses, ye would have believed me, because he wrote of me. But if you believe not his writings, then how shall ye believe my words? In other words, every Jew who was accepting the Old Testament, who was really accepting the Old Testament, did accept Jesus. All men, he goes on to say up there, must honor the Son if they're going to honor the Father. And this brings up an interesting question in one very current event. Is it possible then for the Jew to honor the Father and still reject the Son? A very popular idea that the Jew will accept the Father but not the Son. But if these two are one, and if the Son is merely the outward expression, the manifestation of the Father, then the one who rejects the Son must ipso facto be rejecting the Father. It's utterly impossible to accept the Father and not accept the Son. This is Jesus' point right down here. They believed that they were accepting Moses. He said, you really haven't accepted Moses in spite of what you think you've done. If had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me, for he wrote of me. But if you believe not his writings, how shall you believe my words? The God of the unsaved Jew is a figment of his religious imagination. Can't exist. No God exists, Christ is saying, apart from himself. And to reject him is to reject the only God that there is. Even though there may be an appeal to the Old Testament scriptures, the God that's thought of apart from Christ is a figment of imagination. May accept the Talmud, but not the Old Testament, if insist upon rejecting Christ. By receiving Christ, then can accept both the Old Testament and the New.
Well,
yes? I feel that at that point where they reject Christ, saying they have accepted the Father but rejected Christ, that Christ is driving at this very point here. He says, you can't accept me. You can't accept the Father and still reject me. The man who rejects me must reject the Father because the Father is in me. This is the point, seems to me, of the, and this comes back to the significance of his picking out the one man and leaving the other. Otherwise, there would have been no justice whatsoever. It would have been moral action. Yes?
I was going to ask that question. I had interpreted all accepting of Christ. You always need the individual to ask. The action has to come from the individual. And I just have assumed that this was what I think. I waited at the door and knocked.
Yes.
Brought in, and
yes. And
you have to ask him in, and this was another expression of the same sort of thing. He was asking,
do
you want, and waiting for the person to say, yes, I do.
Yes, that's good. And in every one of the miracles, you'll find the same thing. He waits for the desire, the expression of desire on our parts. Behold, I stand at the door and knock, Christ said. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him. But it requires expression of desire on the part of the person. He will not override any person's will.
Part of the act of faith, then.
Yes. 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 And some people have referred to this as being a testing. Maybe a better word is an examining faith. Yes. I have said that that way. You said it the crime a little bit ago. Well, you did, and I was trying to get at it from that standpoint. Yeah, good.
Does Christ
ever create anything from nothing? Yes. At that point where he made the water into wine, he demonstrated the same kind of power. He created life at that point, I believe, where he brought back to life from death.
No, I understand.
Yes.
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 Nothing is Christ ever in
the Bible. An illustration of it. Not that I know of. We are told that he does this, but that he did it to show that he could do it. No. The significance, of course, of his making a change of kind rather than a change of degree, when he changed the water into wine, it's not a change of degree, but a change of kind, was to illustrate the fact that he had this kind of power, that he could do this. Then in John 1, of course, we read that in him were all things created. Without him is not anything made that was made.
To me, this would be as God made it, as Jesus did it.
Yes, and you're right. He did these things as God.
I don't know why I'm asking a question.
Uh-huh.
Real difficulty here. This is a pretty good start.
Yes, it is. And this is the point, you see, that Jesus home to them. And this was why they brought up their opposition. This was why the circumstances were planned in such a way that they would challenge him. Not only had he healed the man, but he had done it on the Sabbath, and only God had the right to determine what would be done and not be done on the Sabbath. So they were concerned, and they were bickering on this, and out of this setting, he was enabled to draw this lesson, emphasize this point. Now, the thing that is significant, I think, about this, is that in putting this new kind of life into a person, he has to make something out of nothing. He has to put something there that's not been there before. Remember our three questions in John: who is Jesus? What life, what kind of life is it that he gives? What do we mean by believing? Was that second one? What kind of life is it that he alone can give? He puts a new dimension into life. He gives a kind of life that's never been there. And usually people say, well, it's everlasting life, but it's not so much how long it is. It's not the chronological dimension as it is the moral dimension. He puts into a person a kind of life that has not been there before. A new heart, David said. He prayed that God would create in him a new heart. And this was to put in him a new kind of life, a kind that he would not have.
I was going to offer a vicinity. It's hard enough for us to understand. But I think one reason some of us have a harder time is that in all of our Sunday school training and upbringing, we have been taught God the Father created.
Yes.
Jesus was God's Son. They've been delineated, and this has been what I believe because I've been back teaching Sunday. One, I see the pattern repeated, and this is my Father's will. We get the idea that God the Father did the creating, and as a creator, is kind of discussed too much. I mean, it's hard to show them, but I think that it could be brought in and Jesus created.
Now, that there's a significance that Christ's work of creation is related to his work of redemption, his work on the cross, his work of making and his work of saving. What he made, he's interested in saving. Not only he's interested in saving it, but he has certain rights insofar as conserving or redeeming that which he has made. I don't know, I think that one evening, the story of a little boy who had his boat, and it rained hard up in the mountains, and the little boat went down into the valley, and he lost it. He found it in the store window, and the storekeeper said he'd have to buy it back if he wanted it. And so the little boy went back and worked for a long, long time until he had enough money to buy his boat. And then he went in and plunked his $5 down on the table and walked out with the boat, and the storekeeper heard him say as he walked out the door, "Now, boat, you're mine twice. You're mine because I made you, and you're mine because I bought you." And somehow or other, Christ is creator and Christ is redeemer that he had made, and that he would follow through on what he had made and have a right to do it, that these two things are related to. I think this is why in the beginning of the Gospel, according to John, we have the record of Christ's creating and the first miracle, this beginning of miracles, did Jesus at Cana of Galilee. At the very beginning of his public ministry, the first public act that he did, really, at the wedding there, was to change, to create, to make something out of something that was not. However, it was a case of making something out of something.
One thing bothers me is this observance of the Sabbath. The only people of this day were as intelligent as people of our day, but to me, what thickness of souls you had on the Sabbath is a bit ridiculous, and I'm wondering that in year 2000 they're going to think that we were ridiculous and not say that I came on them or some such thing.
This is a...
How could that possibly have anything to do with the Sabbath? I mean, you certainly wouldn't think the scriptures do. Anything else to
This is the thing that I think we should keep a close eye on, and in order to drive us back to the spirit of the day itself and to God's objectives and his purposes in resting and his definition of resting. Fathers, grandfathers maybe, did not believe in washing, in cooking, or in writing any more than was actually necessary on the Sabbath. Our children they don't take their bath on Saturday evening. They get up and shower before they go to church on Sunday morning, and they don't shine their shoes the evening before. They do it that morning as a general rule. And on the other hand, they may frown on certain other activities on the Sunday. Now, what will our grandchildren do? There's a development here from age to age and generation to generation. What's going to be right? But you could prove almost anything by looking at the past in terms of what people have done. But let's get our eye focused on what God did when he rested and what Christ did when he worked. I preached a sermon once, and I won't do it tonight, on how Christ worked on the Sabbath. It seemed to me that he picked that particular day to work on, when it would have been so easy for him to have avoided that day, because they were watching him, seeking to find fault. And they tried to fit him into their mold. And he says, "But I don't fit into your mold. You fit into mine. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. I show you what to do. You don't show me what to do on this particular day. My Father worketh hitherto, and I work. He works in me. And what we do is right. And we set the pace on this." Therefore, if instead of getting our eyes on those around us, we would get our eyes on what he does and what Christ did on this particular day, and if we would follow through with this, then it seems to me we would be resting no matter what it was. To trace the development of the Sabbath or the Sunday in history, I think it's a dangerous thing. To get our eye on what Christ did, it's his objective, I think. This is personal opinion here. But God's objective, I believe, was to say we were not to use the 7 days in for personal gain. Not to use every day for personal gain. One day just the same way as the other. But that we were to set aside one day in particular to come close to him. And this is a very sensible thing. We see so many of these couples in the university housing areas who marry early, and then they begin